Welcome back. We will reconvene the Senate Health and Human Services Finance Division for Wednesday, April 8th for the evening session. We have four bills remaining to go through. First up is Senator Hayden with Senate File 1836. Welcome good. To the committee.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it. Good evening to the committee members that are present today. Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 1836, which deals with the issue of menthol-flavored tobacco in the African-American community. The tobacco industry targets menthol products for African-Americans, youth, and other populations. African-Americans, menthol cigarettes, smoke menthol cigarettes at a higher rate than the general population. Nationally, 88% of African-American smokers use menthol compared to just 26% in the general population. This legislation is the first step in addressing the problem that contributes to dramatic health disparities for African-Americans in our state and around the country. Mr. Chair, with me I have Latricia Vital from North Point Health and Wellness, and also have Laura Olivan from the Minnesota Department of Health.
Okay, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and present your testimony.
My name is Latricia Vital, and I work at North Point Health and Wellness Center in North Minneapolis. And I'm here to talk about menthol cigarettes. Menthol cigarettes are identified with African Americans in the public eye, but the problem they cause for us isn't always understood. I hope I can shed some light on that tonight. For decades, the tobacco industry has marketed menthol cigarettes deliberately and specifically to African-American people. They advertised in black publications using African-American models and images that were painstakingly researched to appeal to black adults and youth. They placed store and outdoor advertising in black neighborhoods and sponsored music and sport events. They even made donations to organizations in the black community to show what good corporate citizens they were. Today, there are a lot of restrictions on how tobacco companies can promote cigarettes. They can't advertise on television, and direct advertising to kids with cartoons and so forth is banned. But all the ways I mentioned, they have targeted African Americans in the past, and it's still happening. I have a magazine ad from the 1980s, from a Newport magazine ad, and I have a magazine ad from right now. I'm not sure if anybody can tell the difference. Okay, thank you. The only difference actually is the QR code on the ad. As a result of this target marketing, 88% of African Americans who smoke menthols. 88%. When you get that kind of agreement in the legislature, I think it's called the overwhelming majority. You might say, so what? It's a free country. People have the choice to smoke. People have the choice to quit. Well, when you have a billion-dollar industry putting ads full of people who look like you everywhere you go, what kind of choice is that? When they're jamming down your throat, it's addictive, literally, physically, and psychologically. What kind of choice is that? And when the product will kill you if you aren't able to break free of the addiction, what kind of choice is that? Here are the implications for the black community in Minnesota and across the country. The industry tailors its ads to get black people to try menthol. That's one strike against us. The menthol chemical makes it easier to start smoking. That's the second strike against us. Menthol also makes it harder to quit, especially for African Americans. That's three strikes. That is not what I call a choice. As a result, African Americans are more than 30% more likely to die of lung cancers than whites. They have the highest death rate and the shortest survival rate for most cancers. They're 53% more likely to die of heart disease. These are huge disparities, and it's about time somebody did something about it. So I just want to thank Senator Hayden and Senator Champion for bringing this bill forward. A lot of people think that the tobacco problem is over. Well, it's not over for our community, for my community. It's definitely not over, not by a long shot. And I ask you to help improve the health equity and support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Vita.
Thank you.
You have one more testifier. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Laura Olivan, and I'm speaking tonight on behalf of the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm the tobacco control manager for the department and will have responsibility for producing the menthol report described in this bill. The Minnesota Department of Health is in support of this study. While tobacco use among Minnesota adults and youth has declined overall, tobacco use is still a problem, especially among priority populations where use remains persistently high. Menthol is part of the problem. The tobacco industry has a long and well-documented history of marketing mentholated brands of cigarettes to racial and ethnic minorities. As a result, chronic disease and death rates of African Americans are significantly higher. This is a striking example of the dramatic health disparities we at the department are trying to address. This study will provide us with a unique opportunity to contribute to our understanding of beliefs and attitudes of menthol-flavored cigarette usage among the African American community. This community-level data would inform our policy development and help tailor our efforts to better address the needs of the community. As part of this study, we will work in consultation with the African American community to conduct the evaluation effort and engage members of the African American community through a culturally specific input process. Our fiscal note indicates that $200,000 will be sufficient for covering staff time and contractor costs to complete this study and to compile a report, which will include recommendations for addressing tobacco use within the African American community. Our mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. We've made a commitment to health equity and look forward to working in close partnership with the African American community to conduct this study. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Olivan. Any questions of members? Senator Benson.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
I don't have that posted anymore that says Senator Benson has a question. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess what I'm not seeing are the statistics. Smoking's declined overall, but is the African American community not declining as quickly as other communities? And is there an indication that menthol is the problem, or are there other influences that so question one, smoking's declining. Is it not declining in the African American community? And shouldn't we be focused on why there might be a gap instead of just picking one topic?
Ms. Olivan?
Yes. The recent MATS data shows overall decline in smoking rates among adults. We our data on subpopulations doesn't have a very high confidence level, but recognizing not a high confidence level, the data that we do have show African-American smoking rates of menthol consistent with national rates, which are close to 80%. So while
80% of smokers, African-American smokers
are using menthol.
Hey, but that wasn't my question.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, smoking rates are declining. Are African-American smoking rates declining more slowly than the rest of the population?
I don't have the data. I don't have the data on African-American usage rates because the confidence levels in the MATS data didn't give us that data level. However, we know consistently in the youth rates, according, for example, in the student survey, that our priority populations are smoking at a much higher rate. If we look at data like the SHAPE data in the county, the African-American rates are almost 10% higher in counties like Hennepin County, where we do have better access to racial and ethnic data. So we know from data sources like that and from data sources nationally that priority populations are smoking at a much higher level. So overall, when we celebrate the improvements and the decline in tobacco use, both for adults and for youth, we remain concerned about the persistently higher rates of the priority populations. When we've done sub-analyses of other populations, they're significantly higher as well.
And Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, since many, or it appears all, or we're told all the priority populations have higher rates than whites, Caucasians, I don't know how to classify the others, why aren't we focused on all of them? And why we're not bending the curve? I thought that's what the statewide health improvement grants were for. Why we're carving out menthol and African Americans.
Because what the research shows nationally and our own unpublished. Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Ms.
Thank
Oliver.
You. Our data shows us is that among African-American population, the use of mentholated tobacco is alarmingly high at 88% and at roughly 80% in our own state of Minnesota. So it is a strong indicator that it is a contributor to persistently high tobacco use rates. And we remain concerned. And really what we want to do with this report is investigate further. And this is a unique opportunity to go into the community and do all kinds of focus groups and research to better understand the needs of the community, the use rates, and the perspective which will inform our policy development. Nothing to the that I'm aware of is available like this nationally, with the exception of some limited outreach they did in Chicago. So we have the chance to inform not only the national or the state level policy development, but nationally significant contribution.
So, Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, I think
Senator Hayden.
I think to try to address it, and I don't know if I can. So, if we are saying that the smoking rates are higher in the African American community, so we'll just say that. But then we also know that African Americans at 80 to 88% smoke menthol. That's how the two come together. So we're looking at higher smoking rates in this particular priority community, and then we know that there's a direct correlation to those that are smoking at a higher rate are smoking menthol cigarettes. And so the study is to further investigate what that means, what that looks like, things like the advertisement, what is going on in these communities in which the smoking rate is still high, and then we know in particular in this group that menthol cigarettes are kind of the cigarettes of choice. In 2009, Congress gave FDA the power to regulate tobacco and ban all flavoring agents except for menthol. The exact reasons of menthol weren't clear, but many folks in the African American community, especially their high rates, find some correlation to that. So they used to do cherry and strawberry, and all that was taken out of the marketplace by the federal government. But menthol was here, and then there's a correlation to African Americans smoking menthol at a much higher level. So we're trying to figure out what is going on and to further develop this information that the Department of Health and also have the advocates help to get the message out to hopefully start to get those numbers to decrease.
Senator Hayden or Ms. Ollivan, I think Ms. Vita said in her testimony that a couple of the strikes were that menthol actually gets you hooked faster and harder or something like that. Is that evidence settled? I mean, is menthol really an additional addictive factor? Is that known, or would this also be trying to look into that health evidence as well, but I don't see that in here. But is that evident? Is that well settled?
I think there's some indication that individuals that use menthol are more likely to initiate and continue smoking. One of the things that we'd like to do at MDH as part of this effort is to bring in some nationally respected experts and researchers to gather that kind of information to contribute to our knowledge base.
Okay.
Mr.
Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, the fiscal note doesn't say that kind of scientific analysis. It says evaluate attitudes and beliefs. There's an allocation for a stipend for a contractor's time and food at community meetings. It doesn't say we're going to actually find out scientifically if menthol contributes to addiction and makes it harder to quit. Mr. Chair, we need to be careful that what's being represented is what will be accountable. And I have a question, Mr. Chair, and if Senator Hayden would help me answer this. Why is this not coming out of statewide health improvement money?
Well, Madam Senator Chair, Senator Benson, I guess the long and short of it is I think that this is enough of a problem, at least from the advocates and the folks that I talked to, that this is enough of a problem that I thought that it should come out of our general fund appropriation. I'm not ruling out that it could come out of SHIF for all of the SHIF advocates in the room. I'm just saying that I think that this is a issue, Senator Benson, Mr. Chair, that that I was convinced in work and doing some work in the interim that we really have an issue in this community and all of the health-related issues that come with smoking. And then to make the correlation between what we know African-Americans are smoking, that is the object and the opportunity here. So I'm not ruling out that this might be something that the SHIP program could take care of. I just thought in putting the bill together that it would get its own appropriation.
Any other questions of members? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, I think and I have been a proponent of SHIP and have always because it works very well in my Senate district, and I've been very a strong advocate for it. And I believe it was developed for smoking cessation and
childhood obesity.
Childhood obesity. And I actually think this would be a wonderful SHIP program, and I would be anxious to see the results on that. My question to you, is this one of the first studies in the nation on this is?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, in Chicago, they did a series of community outreach consultations and developed legislation that limited menthol sales near schools. That's the only community-informed menthol-related research that I'm aware of. Mr. Chair, if I may answer the question that was expressed by the senator, we did write in three small contracts to bring in some national experts to help inform the process.
But Mr. Chair, my Senator point Benson. Was there's no money allocated to find causation between menthol and addiction and difficulty quitting, and that's what was being represented.
Well, Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Benson. I think that that's duly noted. And Senator Rosen, I think that we'll continue to have this conversation, and if SHIP is the right place, I'll be working with the committee and the chair to figure out where the right place to go. I'm not as wedded on that as much as I am on the health issues that we know that this is, that I've been convinced of is happening in particular in this particular, as they would say, priority population. I'm not always well versed on what I am these days, but I guess a priority population would be the word that we're using today. So that's kind of what we're hoping to do. We do know what smoking does do to folks. What it does, that's well documented, and we do know that rates in African American community is high, and then the rates of menthol smoking is correlation to that. So that's what we're trying to get through, and we're trying to have people like Ms. Olivet and other experts, as well as our outreach workers, to really help us with that. That's the essence of the bill, Mr. Chair.
You know, one comment Ms. Olivet made in her initial testimony was that the administration supports this bill. And historically, we've had kind of a practice that the administration supports the administration's position. Maybe you can clarify. I mean, this isn't in the governor's bill, correct?
Is there a representative from MDHA?
So maybe we could get some clarity on that, because that's the way we've sort of run historically, the governor has a position, and those are the items he supports. And, you know, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm Abigail Mosier. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Health. You are correct. This is not an item in the governor's budget. We are here supporting health equity and efforts related to health equity. As you know, that's a priority for our department and also for the administration. So,
okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Benson?
Mr. Chair, I think if the Department of Health supports it and has the governor's blessing, then they can find the resources for it. I do not think this needs to be on the list of this committee's priorities this year.
Any other questions of members? Anyone else in the audience wish to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1836? Senator Hayden, any last
thoughts? Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1836 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill.
On that motion, any further questions? Senator Sharon.
Yes, just in the interest of allowing the conversation to continue that Senator Hayden would like to have, if this committee is not wanting to promote this as a separate, if after discussion doesn't want a separate funding, is there money coming, spoken, is there a bill anywhere that says that is putting money into the SHIP program this year that this could be related to?
I don't
remember anything.
I haven't seen a proposal to increase the SHIP funding.
Mr. Chair, no. Do you remember the finances on the SHIP? That's
20 million a year?
Yes.
Per year. $40 million for the biennial.
So if it isn't specific, excuse me, Senator. So if it isn't, just for our discussion. If it isn't specific, if we don't do this specific appropriation, it would then become a competitive grant within the SHIP program. Is that correct? Is that what you would understand to happen?
Well, I don't. Can MDH apply for grants themselves from an MDH grant program? I mean, I think part of the deal was this MDH tobacco unit, I don't remember the exact title, was going to conduct this, and I think it'd be a little awkward being a grant applicant and a grant awardee. You know, but welcome back to the committee. Maybe you could provide some clarity.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, members, again, I'm Abigail Mosier, the Chief Financial Officer at the Department of Health. I'll start, and then we have other experts if we go deeper. But the SHIP program, there is not a recommendation in the governor's budget to change the SHIP program. So it would remain funded at, I believe it's $35 million. And so we also, as you know, the structure of the program is that it's the majority of the money actually goes out in grants to local community health boards to actually carry out the work of the program. And then the remainder is funding at the department to provide training, technical assistance, and really make sure that that funding is spent at the local level in ways that really affect public health to the greatest degree. And so this is not really what the program does, this research component and the community engagement that would yield policy recommendations. Now, I assume they could be sort of carried out through that program if this research were to develop into does develop into recommendations that inform communities on how to address the underlying causes and the public health impact, then that could be translated into the technical assistance into that program. But there's not funding available in the program as it's appropriated today to do this work. Does that help?
Senator Sharon.
So I would just appeal that that we at least lay this on the table for possible inclusion. We'll allow Senator Hayden some time to maybe articulate some language still that would direct some of the SHIP money toward this in some way, or at least it would allow for us to continue to have some conversation about how to move this forward if we have an interest in doing that.
On Senator Hayden's motion, any further questions, comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I guess I'd like to thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment from Senator Hayden, if that, I mean, we're talking
Senator
around
Hayden,
you.
A response Senator to Hayden. Senator
oh, yeah, well, yeah, absolutely. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, Senator Rosen. I just think that this is an important issue. You know, I wanted to bring it forward, have exactly this conversation. If it fits better in the SHIP program and we can kind of work out the kinks. It does have this kind of research component so we can continue to gather information to frankly answer some of the questions that was here and then do some of this outreach work, wherever that might fit. I just think it's important to kind of raise this issue. I think that these kind of series of bills that I've introduced around health disparities are really trying to move the ball and to start to do something about the issue as opposed to the admiring it as we've done over the years in this particular committee and Senator Sharon's committee. So I'm not wedded to where or even frankly how, but I do think it is something that we should be talking about and that our health department should be working on to try to reduce smoking in this priority population.
All right, Senator Rosen.
Just a final comment. And Senator, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Hayden, and absolutely we all know that tobacco is the number one addictive drug. Mm-hmm. It is, and this is how you start. So completely understand if there is a need for it. If you could just work on a little of the fiscal note, no matter where you go, that last sentence, it is assumed the contractor will pay community participants a stipend for their time and food. It will be provided at community meetings. Has that ever been really discussed in fiscal notes like that? Or they've talked about
So, Mr.
Food,
Chair,
food
Senator
provided
Rosen,
and
yeah, I didn't write the fiscal note. I just,
yeah, okay.
I just received it, but I am more than willing to figure out what that means. I know that sometimes causes members' angst. I will say this, though, in defense of kind of people who work in priority populations that often, you know, trying to get people to come and to show up. And unfortunately, those populations often are low-income groups that we're trying to gather to talk about what's going on and that trying to provide, I wouldn't say an incentive, but actually an ability for people to show up and to have this conversation. Often, if you've ever been to one of Senator Champion's famous town hall meetings, he does provide food on, you know, of his own, on his own. But that does really often draw people at the hour that they try to get them. So I'm not wedded to that happening. I don't want to open up that discussion. I'm just trying to give maybe some understanding of those who wrote the fiscal note and got some advice for people who do the work why it's probably in there. But I'm not wedded to that either, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Okay. On Senator Hayden's motion, any further comments, questions of members? Seeing none, we'd already opened it up for the public. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
No.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. You are also next with Senate File 1871.
Well, good. If you like that, the last bill, you're going to love this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Healthy children, families, and communities. I mean, who can possibly have a problem?
Who can have
a problem? Mr. Chair, members, I have Senate File 1871, which builds off a continuing conversation we have been having about health outcome disparities. Last year, the Department of Health released a white paper tying income to health outcomes. Year after year, we've heard about the persistent gap in health outcomes between white Minnesotans and Minnesotans of color. This bill is an attempt to move that conversation forward and resolve some of these gaps. Senate File 1871 asks MDH to award grants to community-based organizations to help these organizations by providing often needed technical assistance to them. With me, I have Alfred Babington Johnson with the Stair Step Foundation, Melanie Peterson with the Office of Health Equity.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Babington Johnson, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Alfred Babington Johnson, and I'm the founder and CEO of StairStep Initiative. I'm quite pleased about the opportunity to give testimony today for two reasons. First, we have an opportunity to revisit one of the most important developments related to health in Minnesota as a community, the February 2014 report of the Minnesota Department of Health entitled Advancing Health Equity in Minnesota. This was an important document, and if taken seriously, it has the potential to light our way to a better tomorrow for all the citizens of the state. We are told that the growing economic inequities and the persistence of health disparities in Minnesota are a matter of life and death for many. Despite high rates of infant mortality, diabetes, and suicide in vulnerable segments of our population, the MDH reports that multiple efforts to close the significant gaps in health outcomes have had little or no impact, and in the specific words of the report, essentially, we have been running in place. Any constructive journey must begin with truth-telling. This report has placed the truth before the policymakers of this state. Fact. When groups face serious social, economic, and environmental disadvantages, such as structural racism and a widespread lack of economic and educational opportunities, health inequities are the result. Lest that conceptual statement left confusion, the report goes further. African American and American Indian babies die in the first year of life at twice the rate of white babies. African American and Hispanic Latino women in Minnesota are more likely to be diagnosed with later stage breast cancer. The citations could continue, but the case is very well made. The truth could set us free if we accepted it and operated in its light. My second reason for embracing this opportunity to dialogue is to avoid societal insanity. Albert Einstein was said to have defined insanity as doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. The Minnesota Department of Health has confessed that we are in an insane trap. I quote again, "Multiple efforts to close the significant gaps in health outcomes have had little or no impact, and in the specific words of the report, essentially, we've been running in place." Mr. Chair, the proposed legislation before you is an opportunity to stop the madness and seek higher ground. If social determinants of health, including education and poverty, contribute almost half of the impact of our health outcomes, then why haven't we empowered the Minnesota Department of Health to explore the ability to impact these social determinants? This legislation affords the opportunity for the state to partner with its citizens to seek innovative approaches to retarding social erosion and bad health outcomes. In the Dead Poets Society, Robin Williams urged his charges to seize the delicious moments presented and to exert their best thinking and doing to make tomorrow better than today. Commissioner Ellinger closed his remarks in the report saying, "We are blessed with a great challenge and a great opportunity." I quote Robin Williams, "Carpe diem." Thanks to Senator Hayden for the opportunity.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
My name is Melanie Peterson Hickey, and I'm the acting director for the Center for Health Equity at the Minnesota Department of Health. I'm pleased to be here today to provide comments on this bill. Just a little background on the Center for Health Equity. The Center for Health Equity was established in February 2014 with the primary mission of leading a department-wide effort to bring a health equity lens and intention to MDH's existing efforts and partnerships both internally and externally. Over the course of the last year, we've had a lot of opportunity to learn a lot of things about health equity and what it is that we need to be doing or we need to be doing differently to address these significant and long-standing disparities in health outcomes among populations of color and American Indians in Minnesota. The Center has supported and challenged the work of MDH to move beyond the identification of existing disparities in health outcomes to naming and acting on the underlying factors that contribute to health. A few more of the findings from our work over the past year include the following. To advance health equity, we need to start with an understanding of health. Health is not merely the absence of disease, but is a state of complete physical, social, and mental well-being. We also learned that we need to be clear about what creates health or what makes it possible for some people and communities to be healthy and others to suffer poor health. The factors that create health include some familiar factors such as access to health care and health behaviors, but the conditions and the circumstances in which people are born, grow, live, work, age, and worship actually make the greatest contribution to health outcomes. We call these the social determinants of health. The social determinants of health are shaped by a set of forces that are beyond the control of the individual. In this instance, then, when we talk about health disparities, we talk about the disparities as the physical symptoms of the differences in these socially determined circumstances. The positive aspect of this is that because these factors are socially determined, change can occur. In the course of the last year, we've also came to understand the connection between living conditions and the community's capacity to act to change those conditions. We realize that to achieve health equity, we must support strong communities and build capacities in all of our communities in Minnesota to determine their own healthy future. We believe that the disparities then, including disparities in child health outcomes, learning success, and adult chronic disease, exist in part because the opportunity for healthy development and well-being is not equitably available for every child and family in the state. The opportunities or lack of opportunities created through the impact of negative social factors are significant drivers for how families and communities are able to offer social, emotional, and cognitive support to their children. As well, the lack of opportunities for health contributes significantly to the cycle of poverty, adversity, and trauma that so many of our communities experience. I believe that the factors in this legislation are consistent with many of our past learnings, including the importance of building community partnerships, creating safe, stable, nurturing relationships and environments for children, families, and communities, the recognition of the need for social, cultural, and economic well-being, community-led approaches and support for community leadership, and planning based upon community strengths and needs. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you. Senator Hayden, maybe, you know, I'm just reading this. I can't quite get what a grantee would submit, what would this. So let's say we give $100,000 to somebody, what are they going to do with it? I can't see it in the language here, really, and it didn't come clear to me through the testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think I'll defer to my testifiers with it, but you know, the basic understanding is, as we start the idea is, we're starting to move forward on this issue of dealing with the health disparities, and in particular the social determinants of health, what the conditions that people are living in and other issues that are causing them to have this. One of the things that when folks brought it to me was trying to create an environment in which MDH would work with these particular community-based agencies, pick a health disparity issue and work with them in order to start to deal with that particular issue. But they wanted to work with the Department of Health to ensure that we had all of the metrics and reporting criteria and really develop what that process would be. It isn't as clear, I think, as even we usually would see it, but part of that is because we want to work with communities to come and tell us what they think those issues are, work with the Office of Health Equity to work that out into something that would be manageable, reportable, and measurable in order to work on those health disparities. So this would be quintessential, your more bottom-up process versus the top-down, which I think Reverend Babington Johnson is kind of referring to as he says we continue to do the same thing over and over again. So I recognize that it isn't as clear as we normally would like it, and that may give the committee some indigestion, but that is part of the design of the program. I don't know if they...
Mr. Chair Johnson?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I think the fact that you can't see it clearly is one of the most delightful aspects of this.
Let me
share my vantage. Innovation isn't necessarily something you see from the beginning. You create an atmosphere for innovation, and then unlikely things emerge. That's precisely the point. The Department of Health has laid out this clarity that social determinants of health are overwhelmingly the factor that is not being treated in its approach to health. We're going with cough drops and Band-Aids, and we can see what they do, but how do we actually begin to prompt and support innovative thinking with the community, partnering with the Department of Health, to come up with ideas about how the social determinants can be impacted? I think that's a major plus in this.
Okay. Any other questions?
I'm struggling.
To be eligible to receive a grant, the applicant may be local and must demonstrate the ability to convene, coordinate across agencies and systems, and implement evidence-based and practice-based strategies at the local level.
Mr. Chair, strategies for what?
I don't know. Okay. Senator Sharon, and then Senator Benson.
I don't want to put words in anybody's mouth, but I'm extracting from this that the goal of the grants, why I'm a little confused about this evidence-based practice and based strategies, is because part of what I've been learning in the course of our hearings and as in the course of and the policy committee in here is that part of the problem of being able to reduce the disparities is that we're using evidence-based strategies that are based on a Western viewpoint rather than being built out of the community and developed using the strengths and the assets of the culture of the people who have the health disparities. I don't know if I've articulated that very clearly. Mm-hmm. But, and I think what this is trying to articulate but doesn't do very well, and I'm sorry, it just doesn't, is and needs some language help that I might be able to help you with, is to do grants that start to develop those strategies that may not be scientifically demonstrated to, because we haven't done it. I mean, this is all innovation, so we don't have the outcomes to show it. But that we start to build and test some interventions to reduce health disparities that are built out of the community's culture and their assets of that culture to create a better outcome. I think that's what this is about. But it just doesn't say that, and it doesn't give us a measure to know if we do $1 million, how we will know we've accomplished that. So I think we're struggling with the language.
Senator Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Shannon, I think you are doing exactly what you're articulating, what we're trying to figure out. And so you have a sense of, I've been on this committee long enough, of members that will say we want it to be kind of evidence-based. We want to know what we measure, and we want to know what the value is. But then we would have advocates and others that would say in the report that said that that way of doing things has not produced what we're looking for. So we're trying to figure out how to get that new. And when we say evidence, we say it in this very scientific way. But there are people who live in these communities who feel like they have evidence, though not necessarily, you know, researched, if you will, or researched through our traditional way, that says we think that this will work. So we're trying to, I think that the language you see is somewhat boilerplate language in trying to create an environment where this committee and frankly the legislature would know that they're going to kind of get something out of this. And so I do think that we struggle with language around innovation, and frankly we're struggling with language in these communities that really kind of get this innovation that we're looking for. So in a very practical way, you know, if I were to go into some of the communities that I represent and go talk to them, they would say, well, you need to do this, this, and that, right? And I don't, you know, I won't begin to just say what that is. That may not necessarily work very well in the context of what we do here, but if we were able to get that information, we're able to work with the Department of Health and put that together, then we can then we're able to bring back that information and say, here's what's really working in these particular communities. And that's the struggle that we have here. And so I would be struggling if I was over there too, trying to figure out how to get that and make sure that this is a value. I think what we're saying is that we're trying to put the Department of Health in and their Office of Health Equity as they grow and go on a new path to really help with that. But there also needs to be resources in which to do that. So they'll be the stewards of the dollars, but resources to do that, to work with community-based organizations. It's not much different than the bill I just had before you. And we're going to struggle with this. But what I'm struggling with even more is this continued conversation around health disparities and our inability to do something about it, though we've identified it. That's the best that I can articulate.
And Senator Lori,
Senator Sharon, follow-up.
I think... I wish we'd had more time to be able to maybe have this go through the Health Policy Committee, because, you know, I think you did say, somebody did say along the line, you know, how would we see this sort of rolling out? And one of you said, well, maybe, you know, it's a community-based initiative, grassroots initiative. We might say in the language that the grant requirement would be that a community, define the community, would identify a disparity,
That'd be the first thing that we could say. And then have a community conversation about methods that you'd like to try to reduce that disparity. And, you know, I mean, you could articulate this in a way to get where I think you want to go. And it just isn't going to be something that we're going to be able to do
right
here, I don't think. So.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I don't disagree with that. And maybe, you know, how this process works, maybe we should have had a more thorough conversation. And I'm certainly, you know, we can figure that out in the context. The problem, though, is that we have so many disparities. As we've all seen, we have so many issues that we're trying to address that we're also trying to figure out. So if we kind of lay out this particular one, we were just talking about smoking, obesity, healthcare access, diabetes, heart disease, right? I can take up a lot of the committee's time talking about what these disparities are and how they've been outlined. What we're trying to find is these kind of innovative, you know, we're using this language, but these solutions in the communities that work. It could be FQHC clinics that are partnering with faith-based organizations that are working with street outreach workers to try to figure out how do we convene them to figure out kind of what's driving these issues and how can we start to stem the tide. That isn't as eloquent as I don't know how to make it even more eloquent other than spending a tremendous amount of time and maybe doing a work group, you know, the work group process. I mean, and I'm always open for that. I like work groups. But I'm just saying that I think that that's the issue we have is we have this huge issue of health disparities in these priority populations, and we're trying to now, this is an attempt to try to move the ball on that, but I don't know if I'm able to articulate it as eloquently as we can.
Yes, you like the priority populations.
I like that. That's a new one. Yeah.
Mr. Babington Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I think part of the difficulty is you're starting the conversation with trying to find a disparity instead of what this seems to be speaking to is how do we impact the social determinants of health that lead us as an outcome to the disparities. So if we start with the narrow thinking of, okay, we're going to impact diabetes, then let's do diabetes programs. If you're going to do smoking cessation, so be it. But the question that is absolutely unengaged is how do we get at the social determinants of health in a way that is intentional with on the backside of that improving those outcomes. I'll give you a sort of a back example of something that did and didn't occur. When the state of Minnesota recently got $10 million of the Department of Health to do a study on diabetes and whether or not incentives work to get people of color involved in diabetes programs, that came from the towers, and it came forward into the community. It was, okay, let's do this. Well, the mechanism was to use the I Can Prevent Diabetes program developed by the CDC, which is an evidence-based program. And so it was presented to the community, let's do this. Well, the I Can Prevent Diabetes program already has an institutional partnership that at the time was United Health and the YMCA. And so the delivery of the I Can Prevent Diabetes program was to come through the YMCA with their set of coaches and what have you. And the community was sidled up to the discussion and say, okay, so yeah, we're going to do this. And yeah, the coaches are going to come from the YMCA. And the question came, where in here is the capacity to build in the community its ability to both present the program and benefit economically from the program in such a way that if poverty is an issue, why aren't we intentionally looking for ways to direct dollars to impact poverty intentionally, strategically? So it is about innovation because it's untapped territory. It's not being done. And so to begin by simply saying, well, which disparity are you going to take on, what have you, is to lead us back to the standard thinking that has us where the department reports we are essentially running in place.
Senator Benson, did you still have a question?
Oh, I have lots, but I'm going to pass.
Okay. Any other questions of members?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do we have a definition on community population? Can somebody explain that to me? I'm just looking. I'm just looking at 1.23 talks about the benchmark that for that community population. Just wondering where you're trying to get at that, Senator Hayden, on the first and second page there, 2.1 and 25% of a community population and percentage of non-white population is 40% of greater of community population. Poverty level. It's poverty.
I think that's just community. I think it's just population, right? Probably would work. I mean, the population of that community is how I read that, but maybe.
What's a community?
Maybe Ms. Peterson-Hickey, you could.
Chair and members of the committee, I think when we referred to community in this particular bill, we're talking about those communities that are most impacted by health inequities, health disparities. And so it would be populations of color and a number of other populations that experience these inequities.
Mr. Chair, you
Senator
could,
Rosen.
You could have communities that are actually white, Caucasian, that are in poverty, and it just seems like this would be strange language to be in statute, community population. That I'm just struggling with that just a little bit, Senator Hayden.
Good. Senator Hayden, any?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, we're a little loosey-goosey on our.
Very good.
on our language, and so I would look to for some help. I think that the intent of the bill, obviously, it's in a health equity lens, so we would be looking at these communities of color who are priority populations who really have been studied long in this health equity report. However, I'm not adverse to looking at other communities that the socioeconomic factor may be an issue too. So I think that was the intent, because so much work had been done. We have a new office that has been reformed to look at this issue. The Department of Health Equity Report has been kind of gone national now in terms of its findings. And so that was the intent of it, because of the kind of particular issue that we've had over the years of dealing with this issue of health disparities in the priority population.
Senator Sharon and then Senator Fischbach. Senator Sharon.
Well, I would just say to Senator Hayden that I think I understand in a limited way, not anywhere to the degree that you and your testifiers understand the complex problem of getting actions directed towards reducing health disparities that work with special populations, communities, through their cultural, faith-based perspective. I absolutely understand the goal of that, and I support you in that. And I would really like to help articulate that, but I don't think we can do that here. And I don't think this does it adequately for the committee to feel comfortable with $1 million appropriation. So I really believe, and I agree with you, you've heard me say it a million times, I'm so tired of hearing over and over and over again that what we already know, that there are enormous health disparities, and there are educational disparities, and disparity. It's time to start to do something like you're trying to get at here with this initiative. I just don't think we're going to be able to fix the language here tonight enough to get us there, but that's why a task force or a work group or something to really try to get this down would be great. I see this was introduced late, 318. So,
right. So, Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon.
Hayden.
So, here's kind of what I think about that. So, we are kind of wrestling around trying to figure out how do we fit this kind of round peg in a square hole, or vice versa. How do we do it? It's important to us. I was kind of being a little facetious with the task force. I think we've actually studied it enough. I think we've had enough task force on this issue. If the committee doesn't feel comfortable, I know that we're laying it over. We have to sit down. If there's language changes that people feel comfortable, I'm more than willing to visit with members to kind of tighten this up, and I was being facetious about loosey-goosey. I left it broad for a reason. That makes them feel better. And also, obviously, working with the committee to figure out what we actually can do, trying to help out the Office of Health Equity as they move forward. However, I will say this. If the committee's not comfortable with it, then it's okay. I'm okay with laying it. I would be disappointed, but I think that it would send a very loud and clear message to communities that we're trying to work what the legislature wants to do with this issue. So I think we should just think about what we want to do. I know that we still have some time left in the session. It was intentionally broad by the design, by the folks that kind of brought it in consultation with the Department of Health to try to figure out if we can do this a new and different way. If we got to go back to our same old way, we could write a bill to just appropriate $1 million to the Office of Health Equity, let them figure it out and see if they have it, but doesn't necessarily bring in this broad and rich and robust group of community folks that are really wanting to get involved with this. So that's the committee's pleasure. I'm a member of it. I do think that we can shape this in a way that probably makes members comfortable, but if they're not ready to move forward, then we know what that motion would look like. I won't be making it, though.
Senator Hayden, I appreciate your comments. I think we should lay this over and consider it and keep talking about it and thinking about it a little bit. I do understand the problem with doing the same thing over and over and never getting at the root cause of our issues, and I'm incredibly sensitive to it. But the downside of something of this that I just need to articulate, I remember vividly, I don't know, a year and a half ago, when MDH tried to loosen up some of their grant criteria and be a little less rigid and got hammered pretty good by the Office of the Legislative Auditor for not overseeing some of the grantees that were out there wasting a bunch of money. And that actually sets our attempts to combat disparities back significantly. And so that's, one of the reasons we actually do try to have some sort of framework that we can rely on so that we know what we're expecting to get from an investment of this size. And so, the discomfort is okay. It's something that I think we can and are going to have to come to grips with, but we'll have to talk about it a little bit more. I do know Senator Fischbach had a question as well.
And Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to pass because it sounds like we all understand. I won't ask questions about specific language, okay. But I did want to point out to Senator Hayden that I'm not paying you $5 for saying loosey-goosey this time.
Well, Mr. Chair, Fischbach, I thought that was still on, but I guess it wasn't. Mr. Chair, with all seriousness in the committee, this is really and I wish we did have a little more time. Sometimes our communities don't work on the same clock that the legislature does, and that's something that we're also working with really closely with community. But that actually is kind of the issue as well, is trying to understand, how does our process work? How do we do things? How do we get this? How do we articulate this and get these ideas out? How do we get people over to this Capitol to testify and to give us some advice on this issue? I think that is how to embolden our new offices that we're trying to do to create a department to do that. So we're really trying to do that. So I think, once again, I'm not wedded to every single word here, but the idea, but doing it in a way that we have some fiduciary responsibility to taxpayers, of course, in making sure that it actually does something. And doing something may mean that we're actually curbing what we need to do to stem the tide, or we're gathering information that helps us down the line really develop a process. And once again, I really am sensitive to the Office of Health Equity and that the work that they need. When I talked to them today a little bit about their fiscal note, one of the things we talked about is them building their department and really in which to do this. We know this. If we don't start to work on this in a real way, the cost is astronomical in our community in terms of healthcare cost, access, people not being able to be productive. I think about all the construction that's going on around us. People can't do this if they're not well. So I'm not sure the best way. I'm open to listening to all members of this committee to figure out what is, but this was really an idea that came from the community to start to talk about it.
Senator Rosen,
yes,
did you have
yes, thank
Rosen.
You, Mr. Chair. And I know, Mr. Chair, you've from the onset,
onset, one of your priorities was disparities. And I'm hoping that as we go through and we're putting the budget together, I've said the same thing about mental health. You know, can we kind of have a sheet of how much we're appropriating for mental health? And perhaps the same thing with disparity issues, whether it's health or any other education or transportation or anything to do with the priority populations. It would be nice to maybe, if we could, just set them aside to see exactly where the money is going and where the gaps are, and if we're doing it properly. And because we certainly do not want, that would set us back greatly if we appropriated money and it did not come to fruition and it was another OLA report or something. I would hate that. So I want to make sure we do this and do it right, and then there's no overlap.
Absolutely, Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Rose, I couldn't have said it better. I think that that's what we're getting at. And sometimes we just don't know the best way in which to have the conversation, but I'm excited because we are having it.
Right.
Once again, regardless to if it's Senate File 1871 or if there are other ideas along the way or we figure out ways to get what we're looking for. But I do think to have a conversation that actually starts to say we're going to do something about this issue, however that might work and what the committee and the legislature's pleasure is, what I'm arriving at, is what I'm hearing community members, is what I'm hearing the department saying that they want to move into that phase. And that's what this bill was an attempt to do and to have that conversation. If this isn't, the language doesn't quite fit with folks. I mean, even when I kind of read it, I thought it was loose, but I wanted it to be intentionally kind of broad so that we could have this thorough conversation.
So, Senator Hayden, we'd have to change the appropriation to accommodate the admin costs of $213,000. We can make that amendment if you wanted, or we can lay it on the table as is and understand that we'd have to change that appropriation.
Well, Mr. Chair, why don't we lay it on the table as is, and then as we have this conversation, we can incorporate any changes if we see this later down the road.
Okay. Senator Hayden, you got a motion?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1871 for possible inclusion in the health care finance omnibus bill.
Is there anyone else in the public who wishes to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1871?
So.
Seeing none on Senator Hayden's motion, any last questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hayden. And Senator Hayden, you have one more.
Oh, one more. This one. Now, this one.
This one
is for the children. We should have no problem with this one here. Mr. Chair, I have Senate File 1199.
Do you have an A1 author's amendment?
Looks like I do have the A1 author's amendment to get the
Senator
bill.
Senator Hayden moves the A1 author's amendment. All those in favor? Oh, incorporating after line 2.7, an effective date of January 4th, 2016. It says. That's to sync with the fiscal note.
Oh.
Yep, a 1 month billing lag is assumed.
Where did he put it?
Rates would be implemented January 4th, 2016. Sure enough, that's what it says in the fiscal note. So that's what we're going to make the bill say, that so that it matches with the fiscal note.
That's right.
So, again, after line 2.7, we're going to insert an effective date of January 4th, 2016. Incorporating that into the A1 author's amendment. On that amendment, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This bill would allow more families to enroll.
Senator Hayden, before we do this, maybe I should take a minute to explain, although we don't have all that many members here, this effective date thing. We're going to have this crop up every now and then in fiscal notes. There used to be an issue where if the department could not implement a proposal in the timeline that a member proposed to have a policy go into effect, they would say in the fiscal note, yeah, well, we can't get it done on that date. We're going to get it done. The soonest we could get it done is January 4th, 2016. And we used to just accept that in the fiscal notes, and members would have the ability to work with the department and see why it was they couldn't get it, you know, done, and could work with them and see if they could get a fiscal note drawn to a different date, and that, that work could go on beyond that. But now in working with MMB, MMB doesn't want to sign off on fiscal notes that aren't drafted to the bill, so the workaround is that we're going to make amendments to the bills to insert the effective dates that are the soonest that the departments can actually incorporate them. It still allows members to have that conversation with the department and MMB to try to see what the right start date and cost is, and that all that will work. But we will have these amendments a few times over the next few days, and it is relatively new. I just learned of it this afternoon myself. But we can expect this a few times, and just to try to explain it. If members have questions, I'm happy to go through it again. But with that little tangent,
good.
Senator Hayden.
Well, Mr. Chair, no, I can always count on you for a tangent. No, I'm just kidding. Mr. Chair and members, I have Senate File 1199. This bill would allow more families to enroll in the basic sliding fee child care assistance, including more than 5,500 on the waiting list, and would raise provider reimbursement rates so child care providers can afford to accept CCAP families. This legislation is supported by the Kids Can't Wait Coalition, a growing group of organizations dedicated to creating affordable, accessible child care opportunities in our state. Child care benefits all Minnesotans. It's a two-generational approach to broader economic security because it helps parents get to work and children to succeed in a consistent and nurturing environment. Child care should be affordable and accessible for all Minnesotan families, but for far too many families it isn't. The average cost of child care for an infant in a center is nearly $14,000 a year. When child care isn't affordable or accessible, parents struggle to find and keep good jobs. Children may suffer long-lasting consequences brought on by economic insecurity and a lack of consistent and dependable care. Our communities and our states suffer because business struggles to find and keep the employees that they need. That's why it's so important to increase our state's commitment to the Child Care Assistance Program, or CCAP. CCAP provides parents with flexibility they need to get to work on time and full-time and bring them a paycheck to help meet their family's basic needs. Mr. Chair, members, CCAP can be used to cover care during all hours of the day and weeks that the parents may work, including early mornings, late night, and weekends. By allowing parents to use providers accepting CCAP payments, parents can choose a provider that meets their families and children's unique needs. Mr. Chair, I was going to have a testifier by the name of Elizabeth Mitchell, who did a wonderful job in the policy committee. However, she wasn't able to make it, so I do have the executive director of the Children's Defense Fund, Peggy Flanagan, to read her testimony and give us comments.
Ms. Flanagan, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Peggy Flanagan. I'm the Executive Director of Children's Defense Fund Minnesota, and I'm honored to be here to read the testimony of Elizabeth Mitchell. Elizabeth regrets that she couldn't be here. The time when this hearing occurs and that she doesn't have child care this evening with her 4-year-old and 12-year-old has presented an obstacle in her being here. So with that, I'll begin. My name is Elizabeth Mitchell, and I'm a single mother of a 12-year-old son and a 4-year-old daughter. I had to quit numerous jobs that don't pay enough for me to afford child care for the hours I need. I qualify for the Basic Sliding Fee Assistance Program, but have been on the waiting list, along with more than 5,500 other Minnesota families. Nearly half of my income goes to pay for child care expenses. It is a struggle every month to find a way to meet my family's basic needs. I recently graduated with an associate's degree, and I hope to find work in my field and go back to school to become a public defender. If I had assistance with my child care expenses, I wouldn't have to constantly worry about how to pay my bills. If I had basic sliding fee, I could go to work knowing that my kids are cared for. If I could go to work and begin to save money, I could also save money for my future education. My children are old enough to understand that money is tight. I do my best to reassure them that everything is going to be okay, but honestly, I'm struggling every day to believe that. That is the end of her comments, but I also just wanted to note, I am honored to be able to present her testimony because I was a CCAP kid, And my mom used the child care assistance program. She was a phlebotomist at Abbott Northwestern Hospital. She went back to school. During that time, we needed care on evenings and weekends because her schedule was a bit challenging. But just wanted to lift that up and say that I am an example of this two-generation approach to ending poverty, and that if you need to put an additional face on this issue, feel free to use mine. So thank you for this opportunity.
Ms. Flanagan, thank you.
Well, Mr. Senator Chair, I think that that's just the end of our formal testimony. I think that our testifier really kind of brought that home about just child care and the ability to continue to work. I think Ms. Flanagan and her her relationship to not only working for the Children's Defense Fund, however, how this program in particular helped her. And then many of you know that I was one of those kids, too, that whatever the program's name was at that point a long time ago, I was helped by people assisting my mother as she went through college and to move on by ensuring that I had pretty good child care as well. It's actually still in my district. It was Messiah Lutheran Child Care Center, and it's actually it's still part of the Lutheran Social Service Network of services.
Any questions of members? Senator Sharon.
Would they describe you as a terror back then?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I did have the nickname Lightning Bug at one point. I think that might have been appropriate.
Senator Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Senator Hayden. Just looking at the fiscal note, which is hefty, just want to clarify. So 5,500 currently on the waiting list. The fiscal note addresses those families, but not necessarily individual kids. So I just want to clarify that. And then if you can talk about the rate increase in a little bit more detail. It's a long fiscal note, so I'm trying to understand it quickly here as well, but maybe you can just walk us through how that would work, and basically also give us an example of, like, what's the average, how do these funds, are how are they expended in terms of what's the average cost that the family gets, or is it a flat fee? Just give us more details on the program, and I certainly support working on this issue very much so. So I'd like to see some traction this session, but I just wanted to have some more information from your testifiers.
Good. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senator Franz, and I'm going to bring Melinda Humdahl up from Legal Aid, who has done a lot of work on helping to develop this bill and especially the fiscal note side of it.
Ms. Hugdahl, welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. The provider rates are set under state law at the 25th percentile. And in talking with DHS, it's done by price clustering, which was a change that was made a few years ago. And so providers are clustered in kind of, they're not exactly geographic as I understand it, but there's a price that's tipped to that. And then it's at the 25th percentile of market rate. So what it really means in reality for providers is that a certain percentage of the rates are covered in full, but a lot are not covered at all or only in small part. So as that has stayed flat and the provider rates, market rates have gone up, we have more and more providers who are falling further and further behind. So their reimbursement is getting to be less and less for CCAP families. So for a lot of providers, it's really getting very difficult for them to continue to take these families because they are essentially taking them at a loss. I mean, already, unless they happen to be in the lowest 25th percentile of their market rate in that price cluster, they're losing money. And for a lot of, especially the smaller family child care providers who are operating at a really thin margin, that makes it a really challenging business decision, even if they really do want to make a commitment to helping CCAP families. So it becomes an access issue, too, for families. And so we've been trying to work at it from that angle. The one difficulty with provider rates is that because they pay across not just CCAP, but our basic sliding fee, but the MFIP population as well. And so as you see it in the fiscal note, it's a large number because of the fact that it does impact a provider rate increases not only the basic sliding fee providers, but all of the MFIP child care providers too. Even if it's a forecasted program, it is an increase they have to pay across the board. So that's why proportionally it's a significant number. So I hope that's helpful.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Franzen.
And Ms. Hungdahl, just a clarification on the families. So we have 5,500 families. Are those kids or are those families? Just to clarify, because I thought the number was larger than that. And that's just on the waiting list. And then, so what would be the total amount of families served, or kids, specifically more the kids, what would that number be?
So I think with this, we would eliminate the waiting list, correct? Every eligible kid and family would be served at a higher rate, at the 50th percentile rather than the 25th percentile rate. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, essentially, yes. We tried to kind of estimate the appropriation at a point that it would effectively eliminate the existing waiting list and maybe some of the families who don't even bother getting on. Some of the waiting lists are 2.5 years long that just don't get on, and then we hear that there's actually money to help serve them. So we try to kind of put it into that range of things. It doesn't technically on a long-term rolling basis eliminate the waiting list, because that's really an issue about forecasting. But yes, that's essentially where the appropriation sits. And the question about the number of children, I'm just looking quickly. I think from the 2014 Child Care Assistance Family Profile, I believe that when the waiting list was around 8,000 families, and, you know, it varies as they kind of take a periodic check, that was about 14,700 families. I'm sorry, 14,700 children. So the number of children served, of course, it depends on in each cycle how many the family size that's involved, but roughly the waiting list is kind of bobbed up and down in that same range of about, you know, 5,000 to 7,000 to 8,000 families over the last few years. So that number is probably pretty close to being in the ballpark, I think.
Mr. Albrecht says he can help you read the fiscal note a little better too. I see that's what you, Mr. Albrecht.
Mr. Chair and Senator Franzen, if you go to page 5 of the fiscal note, in the top table there, the bottom block says estimated number of BSF families who could be served with additional appropriation, 7,050, 6,360, and so on across. And then probably of interest to you as well is on, page 4, the previous page, at the bottom, the middle section there is the amount of this $270 million that's attributable to the rate increase, about $19 million in the first year, $48.5 million in the second year. And then the next line shows you the amount of the total that is going to the basic sliding fee program, the $202 million in 2016 and $170 million in 2018.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions of members? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on page 5, the basic sliding fee average annual cost per family, where does that number come from? If Senator Hayden or one of his testifiers could help me. On page 5 in the top table.
Mr. Chair and Senator
Mr.
Benson. That number would come from the forecast. I mean, I think it's just above there. Where you see it says BSF average monthly cost per family in the February forecast is $1,128. I haven't done the math, but I'll bet you if you multiply that by 12, it's the 14,353.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Albright, because I thought, Mr. Chair, I thought that was the amount that they were going to be spending on child care. This is the cost to the state for each basic sliding fee family. Is that a correct understanding, Mr. Albright?
Mr. Albright.
Albright.
Mr. Chair, Senator Benson, yes. This is what the state pays. So it's not the total cost of the child care.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I just wanted to know if Ms. Hungdahl is using my glasses to make sure that we're there, because we know that they're good luck. So we
know
what
before we got started, I asked you if you had the right glasses.
No, I did.
We're beginning,
just
an hour and a half later, I'm beginning to wonder if you really did have the right pair of glasses.
I just want to make sure you know that I'm sharing, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Hungdahl.
Just to be Claire, I'm glad you're not having a hearing on Saturday because that's when my optometrist appointment is. So I thank Senator Hayden because this print's very small.
Any additional questions of members? Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be spending a little time with this. I just did a quick search, and average cost for a four-year-old child care is $10,470 in the state of Minnesota, and we're going to spend $14,000. And so there's some math here that's not making sense to me. I'm going to need to spend some time with this fiscal note. If we're going to solve this problem, I would like to solve it effectively.
Yeah, Ms. Hugdahl?
Mr. Chair and Senator Benson, I agree with you. The average cost is per family, and so I think given when you look at the families and the number of children math piece, I think that's how it converts over of when you look at how expensive it is for different age ranges and for multiple children. So I think when you're talking about the average cost per family, some of that, you know, we talk about the cost of childcare and it's for an infant in a center. Those costs vary some geographically by the type of provider and by the age of the child. So if you have different combinations of ages of children, that's where that average can look a little different than looking at straight up one category of cost of care.
Thank you.
Any additional questions of members? Seeing none, Senator Hayden.
Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1199 be moved and laid over for possible inclusion in the health care finance bill, HHS finance bill.
As amended.
As amended.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to offer testimony in support or opposition to Senate File 1199? Seeing none on Senator Hayden's motion, any further questions? Senator Franzen.
Mr. Chair, just to line 2.13, do we need to fill that in, or has that already been taken care of with the amendment?
The amendment deleted
okay.
lines 13 to 16 on page
Thank you.
Yep. Any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. Senator Sharon. Senate File
Senator Lori, thank you for the opportunity to present Senate File 1835. One of the things that we need to do is fill in the blanks here, so I'd like to make an oral amendment to Senate File 1835 on line 1.6 and fill in the blank with $1
million. $1 million, okay. On that motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much. And because of my earlier statement in this committee about that the committee is a finance committee and that what we need to be talking about is related to the finance issues of the committee, I have really tried very hard to ask the testifiers to focus on these things. That is not so much about the presence of diabetes and the importance of intervention in diabetes in terms of long-term health care cost containment, although that is a valid issue. But to talk specifically about what this project is about, what it will do, how we will do it, and why it costs $1 million to accomplish it. Wanting you to remember this early morning conversation in which there was a discussion you had in your packet of materials, some information that spoke very specifically about optimal diabetes care by county or of origin or country of origin, and showed the disparities that exist in various populations. So I just want you to know that what this project is about is that issue again. I don't know if you organized tonight's or today's agenda around disparities, but this again is talking about a way of being able to change how we talk about those things that can change healthcare outcomes in the area of diabetes with special groups that have high incidence and poor outcomes in terms of diabetes management by creating new ways of communicating that fit with the group, the culture, the faith, the organization of the groups or the communities that are not being impacted by our traditional public health information programs. So that's really my introduction to this. I want to step away from it and allow the testifiers to speak more to what it is that we're asking the $1 million for, how we think it will help reduce disparities, and who it is that will be receiving this and how they're going to use it. So with that, I'll turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joel Glazer. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations.
And provide your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. AMPRS is an association of 17 independent community radio stations throughout the state of Minnesota. We are teaming up with Twin Cities Public Television and the American Diabetes Association. Twin Cities Public Television has a representative here today, and in your packet of information, you'll see a letter of support and partnership from the American Diabetes Association. In the interest of time, I am going to speak on behalf of the entire group. We've also been partnering with the Department of Health as an informational partner when we initially launched this in a smaller form. As you know, my apologies, the AMPR stations serve underserved communities, especially rural communities and communities of color. We have programming in 12 different languages. That's Hmong, Somali, Oromo, Ojibwe, and many more. Four of our stations are licensed to or affiliated with Native American communities in Minnesota. And as you know, when it comes to diabetes, there is, as Senator Sharon mentioned, a huge disparity. The communities we serve, the minority and the rural communities, have the highest rate of diabetes. Diabetes, as you know, is incredibly costly. My notes keep jumping ahead. My apologies. Research indicates that the information is the strongest tool to prevent diabetes. And through recent research conducted by the Department of Health and our own involvement in these communities, we have learned the best way to disseminate the information to these diverse communities. What we heard loud and clear is the information needs to come from members of their community, people like them, average people, not even experts, not doctors within their community, but average people who can share tangible examples of what they have done to control their diabetes. It makes sense if you think about it. For decades, experts have been saying, live right and eat healthy. It hasn't been working. Diabetes has actually been getting worse. If it's not working in the general population, why would it work within these communities where the problem is even worse? It was that research and our own work within the communities that led us to take control, prevent and manage diabetes. It's a peer-to-peer approach where people within specific communities share their stories and tangible examples of how they personally are controlling their diabetes. The segments are relevant, they're relatable, inspirational, motivational, and they're presented in an interesting and impactful manner. Take Control gives those tangible examples. I was going to have a testifier tonight, but in the interest of time, I will just summarize one of her segments. She was talking about the fact that before she realized she didn't know she had diabetes. Once she found out, she would grab a bag of chips on the way out the door, not because she loved chips, but because it was convenient. She realized that she needed to put a stop to that because she had diabetes. So instead, a couple times a week, she would cut up carrots or celery, put them in the refrigerator, and then she left a tangible example that we then shared for members within her community. We had a Native American woman talking about that in the Native American tradition, it's believed that the body in many ways can heal itself, but you have to remain active. She spoke to the fact that if nothing else, get up and clean, vacuum, do something, and that will help. And they are giving tangible examples instead of just saying, live right and eat healthy. We are take control. We are off to a great start. We need to expand this. That's why we're looking to partner with TPT. AMPRS brings straight statewide radio distribution. TPT brings statewide television distribution. But that's not enough. We're also looking to distribute the audio and video segments through social media. Facebook, Twitter, YouTube are obvious examples, but there are new and emerging and very hot examples as well, sites like Stellar, Storehouse, and JamSnap. We'll create a multimedia, multi-language, mobile-enabled, customized website. It may not seem like it, but I can tell you within these communities, mobile devices, they are very, very connected and mobile-enabled in these communities. We'll partner with community health clinics to distribute the segments and hold town hall meetings, although they won't be town hall meetings. They'll be community conversations to make them more relatable. We aren't diabetes experts, but with the American Diabetes Association and the Department of Health, we have diabetes experts on our team. What AMPRS and TPT provide are the broad statewide distribution. But more importantly, because we are so entrenched in these communities, we bring trust. Our stations are already connected in these communities. Kelvin and his team at KMOJ aren't just serving the African-American community. They are a significant part of that community. The same is true for the Hmong, Latino, Hispanic, and African immigrants in KFAI. Our native stations in Boys Fort, Leech Lake, White Earth, and Fond du Lac are right in the center of their communities, and in fact, these stations are begging us for more diabetes content. TPT brings more than 1 million viewers each month, reaching 70% of Minnesota, and their Minnesota channel expands that reach, further providing access to 99% of the households, either over the air, on cable, or by satellite. TPT also has very strong ties to diverse communities through their partnerships with ECHO, the Emergency and Community Health Outreach for Minnesota Refugees and Immigrant Population. Collectively, we have statewide reach and, more importantly, the trust within these communities with a program that is relevant, relatable, and inspirational. How do we know that this is going to work? Well, for starters, the incredible feedback that we've gotten this far. But we realize that for what we're asking, that's not enough. The American Diabetes Association has a pre- and post-test that we will be able to use to gauge the effectiveness of this project. We intend to engage the University of Minnesota to help us develop a plan that can show the tangible, measurable results. And the Department of Health does track the numbers of Minnesotans who have diabetes and pre-diabetes. And while it will not happen overnight, you should see a drop in those numbers. Diabetes is incredibly costly. You not only have to treat the diabetes itself, it can lead to heart disease, high blood pressure, vision complications, and much more. This can be prevented. We're asking for the money to expand our program so that we can make a difference. It's an investment that will ultimately reduce healthcare costs and ultimately save healthcare spending in Minnesota.
That concludes
Senator
our
Sharon.
Testimony. I failed in making my oral amendment to the $1 million on line 1.6 to add a couple of other statements. May I add more at this time? On line 1.6, after the dollar sign, $1 million in the blank. And then I would like it articulated that $500,000 is to AMPRS, the Association of Minnesota Public Educational Radio Stations, and $500,000 to TPT, the Twin Cities Public Television.
I think, Senator Sharon, it does say divided $1 million divided equally between
okay, good, then maybe I don't have to
AMPRS
say it.
And Twin Cities Public
as long television. As that's what equally means?
I think equally means about half, you know, to each of the two.
It's late.
Okay.
Okay, that's good. That's good.
All right.
Thank you. Then I'll withdraw that request.
Okay. Senator Franzen?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, I appreciate the idea. I actually support the concept. My concern, and I do this as my other hat after the legislature, is that, you know, there's great work being done by other radio stations and TV stations that are working particularly in the communities of color. I know that Univision Minnesota is here, Telemundo, and others and in other communities. So not having them as part of recipients or being part of this outreach concerns me because I know that that's where those communities are going for content and not just maybe not just the $1 million that you talk about in TPT. How many of those are actually the communities of color that we want to reach out. So I don't have that information in front of me. And that concerns me in terms of making sure that those dollars are actually going to targeting those communities as far as TPT and AMPRS, and how are you collaborating with other ethnic radio stations and television stations that are doing the work as well in Minnesota. And also, not just the radio stations, I mean, there's also, I'm guessing you're just focusing on media, but, you know, you talked about social media. There's also other ways to collaborate with other organizations, ethnic organizations that are doing this work.
Senator Sharon, Mr. Glazer.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Franson, first off, I would say that obviously would be paid for with state funds. We would make all of this available to any of the stations, commercial, not any station at all that would want to air it. Perhaps the biggest challenge we would have is that because we are community stations, these are longer in nature. They're 90 seconds in length, and most commercial stations will not accept that. However, we'd be more than happy to work with them and can actually even work with them to tighten that up. These would be translated into multiple languages. As far as the Latino Hispanic community, there are two programs on KFAI. However, KMSU in Mankato has 6 hours. We already have right now 15 segments translated into Spanish, but we are looking for as broad of distribution as possible. That's already the goal, period, similar to what we do with other state funds. When we create MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds, we have schools utilizing, and we make that available for download and make it so. Basically, bring it on. The more people that we can work with to help just make this distributed, that's what we would want to do.
So just Senator to clarify, Franson, Mr. Chair and Mr.
Glazer.
His name?
Glazer,
thank you.
So
would we need particular language in the bill, maybe Senator Sharon, to articulate the fact that the funds can go also to other, that there's going to be some collaboration. It's not just going to be left at the level of AMPRS and TPT. That concerns me again. I just want to make it clear that it's going to go to the people and have a far distribution, that it actually, there's some funds set aside to actually do that work. Because they, you know, what you're saying, if they don't have the capacity to do it, perhaps because they're commercial, that there's some ability to distribute some of this information in those channels by having some of those funds go to those channels of communication. I'm not sure if you're open to that. Certainly, it seems if we want the widest distribution, that we should take up all the ability to distribute that information through all those outlets as much as possible. We're going to use state dollars for it too. So maybe maybe get some reaction if that's something we can work on.
Well, I think I would allow the testifier, of course, to speak to that, but I think that's the development of the product is what we're talking about, being able to develop a product that is both visual and audio, and doing it in the proper languages, and doing it in utilizing the community themselves to communicate the message through the traditions and the culture and the faith of those communities. Making that available to all is a part of this project, and if articulating that more clearly in the language would be helpful, I'd be willing to try to do that before when we come back, if we're so fortunate as to have this in the final omnibus bill. I think the money that's requested here is necessary for these organizations to develop this product and have it be available to those, to that broad range of resources. Would you like this?
Mr. Glazer.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Franson, just to elaborate briefly, and then I believe Mr. Szczesny may want to add something as well. The money that we are looking for here is the development, not for the distribution. It really does not cost us anything to distribute it. It really won't cost any commercial, or, you know, they can choose to try and charge. However, you know, in reality, it's airtime, and it does not charge for them to run that. They will run them as public service announcements, which that's fine, and some organizations will run a longer format. We went with the 90 in order to be most effective because we found that a shorter message it was not effective. So the money that we are looking for here is for the creation, not for the distribution. And, you know, we are public nonprofit broadcasters, so I'm not aware of, you know, there may be grants, but situations where funding goes directly to commercial stations. But, you know, we are the community broadcasters, but we would be charging for the development. Mr. Straczynski.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Straczynski. Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Bill Straczynski, and I represent the interest of public television in this discussion. Twin Cities Public Television is one of six public television stations serving Minnesota. That's how we reach all stations. This collaboration, TPT, would be the primary agency putting together the details, the documents, the video, and whatever for distribution. We would then distribute that through Echo, which we broadcast in 14 different languages, and have a lot of 10-year history going with Echo on programs. We would then distribute it statewide to all the other television stations that we can guarantee, because it's on the Minnesota channel, which Twin Cities Public Television, from an engineering perspective, operates. That's how we reach everybody in Minnesota. We reach 4.5 million people over the air with our towers, and then we reach everybody else through satellite and what have you. And so it would go on the Minnesota channel, which is, for example, where the legislature is carried on that Minnesota channel, and our legacy programs are carried there. We bring a lot of eyeballs to all of that. And we would distribute it for a period of up to 7 years, over and over again, as part of the educational component of that. We've got a pretty successful track record of distributing these kinds of programs, whether it's on cancer or what have you. I mean, we've just done a whole series of things currently. I think that's really important. The other component that comes to mind here, though, is that public television has changed the dynamic now in a digital age. We're a public media resource. And we have, I can just tell you, because I know the numbers in my head, on legacy programming, last biennium, we had 3.3 million web views on legacy programming alone. We track that. We had 7 million views to legacy programming because we have Nielsen ratings. We know what eyeballs watch us and how people really are turning into public TV. We're like the fourth, or pushing to become the third channel, our third most popular entity and watched by the public. So we have that kind of capacity, and we will make sure that it gets distributed significantly throughout this population. We're excited to be a part of the project, and I thank Senator Sharon for considering us.
Senator Benson and then Senator Herr.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Glazer, I had a question about the 90 seconds. I mean, it sounds like some of this is already predetermined. You've got this process and you're going to do this. I don't know how 90-second ads play on social media. I don't know how they translate to commercial PSAs. I don't know many people who have a 90-second attention span to listen to ads about diabetes. We live in a, you know, if you watch Casablanca, they would have a 3-minute conversation without a camera change. Now, if we don't have camera changes every 15 seconds, people change the channel. I am concerned about how effective this is in communicating an idea. I do have concerns about reaching targeted populations in a way that they want to be reached. The Department of Health has billboards. It's supposed to target underreached populations, but it's on freeways in the suburbs. I don't know. People have these good ideas, and they say they're for a purpose. It doesn't feel like that here. You talk about social media and other new technology, and then you talk about a 90-second ad. They're incongruous in my mind. The TPT audience, I have not seen the demographics represented there, but are they significantly Native American, African American, Latino, Hispanic? I get rural Minnesota because I get phone calls about when we're on TV. People call my office and say, I liked your hair today, things like that. But I don't know if they're reaching the communities. No, I'm serious. I got that.
Nobody
call.
Says that to me.
Mr. Chair. And so I understand what you do, and I understand what you're trying to accomplish. I just don't have a lot of confidence that this is a marketing strategy. It feels like you're thinking in the box.
Senator Sharon.
I'd like to – I think that those are fair questions, and I think that there's – you know, that we have – the evidence to demonstrate that these systems that they're asking for the funding have the background and the experience to to design things that work within the culture and distribute them appropriately. So I'd like to allow them a chance to talk about that, as well as that the 90 seconds was related to one form and not to taking that form and applying it to the social media. There would be a different approach to the social media.
Mr. Glazer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Benson, if I may, first of all, let me address the 90-second issue because it's very understandable in that a partnership that we just did with Allina is on late-life care and trying to empower people to demand better late-life care and what matters most to them late in life. And TPT had been doing half-an-hour documentaries, and they asked us how we were going to do it. And at that point in time, we said we were going to look at 90 seconds, and the clients from Allina said, you know, there's no way you can do that in 90 seconds. And we then played them an example, and I have an example that I'd be more than happy to send to the members of the committee. We opted at the request of our author not to play tonight for the sake of time. If there's demand, we can, but I can certainly email that to you and give you an example. But that is one example. We would be doing other things. We're not going to take that 190 and apply that everywhere we go. For starters, Instagram, you can. I think their video is only, 30 seconds. It may even be 15 seconds. Obviously, and when we look at Facebook, we're not going to put a 90-second video on there. We're also looking at longer format shows. The town hall meetings that we talked about, or community conversations, would be recorded and broadcast back as hour-long shows. Especially, we've heard demand within the Native American communities that they would like to see hour-long shows within their communities talking about diabetes. So I apologize if I misled the committee into thinking that we were simply taking 90 seconds and we're going to spend $1 million on 90-second little segments. That was one of the many different aspects, but we did not want to get so in-depth and bogged down with all of the minutia.
All right. Senator Herr? No, and then Senator Franzen, and then Senator Carlson. We've got a live one here.
Hi. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Sharon, I appreciate that you carried this bill. And I know some, I have video production background. So I know that $1 million actually for quality is almost not enough. Almost not enough for quality for TPT and NPR, to make it top-notch quality like what we see on digital screen or what we see here on NPR or what we hear on NPR. But I do have a little concern similar to, Senator Franzen about the outreach, about the network, how you're going to distribute it, to various community. And I like to tie this to more of economic development base. Whether this dollar, when you use for production, I'm sure you're going to have talent in the multiple ethnic group, the targeted community. But would this money also be used to secure staff of that ethnicity too, so that we're not just almost like bringing folks for volunteer or bringing folks for talent, but giving them more secure job. So I will have follow-up question or comment after your...
Mr. Glazer?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Herr, KFAI relies very heavily on volunteers. However, AMPRS, and I just a brief mention just to clear up any confusion, AMPRS is not affiliated with Minnesota Public Radio. We're a separate entity. But AMPRS does not rely on volunteers. We hire professional talent for translation purposes. We do not rely on volunteers because we don't feel comfortable that there are too many dialects and it's too dangerous. So we work with talent within those communities. We work with the volunteers to help us make connections within those communities and help us to remain entrenched. One of the biggest concerns we hear from the various communities is that, in general, the media does what they refer to as a flyby. They come by and they do a quick story on whatever, and they're never heard or seen from again. Our radio stations and TPT with Echo are long-term partners, and they're viewed as partners within these communities. So we're not doing a flyby here. We are working with them on the long term, and yes, we are working with professionals to do it, and we do burden the cost. You are correct. It is more than $1 million to do this kind of production. Part of that is our responsibility and securing additional funding elsewhere to make it happen, but we do make sure that it is of the utmost professional in caliber, and as I mentioned, we can certainly provide examples if you'd like to hear them.
My follow-up question would be, would you give us an estimate, you know, other than hired talents, whether this dollars will go into hiring folks that represent the community that you are targeting?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Herr, we have already hired liaisons within the Native American, African American, African American, Latino, Hispanic, Asian immigrant, and African immigrant as the liaisons. And then we, up until now, and plan to go back to them to in the hopes of expanding this project. And would they have the resources to go beyond that? But we will be, you know, we're going to target the communities that are at the highest risk, and also within our community. It was interesting for me. I will tell you, I had a reverse stereotype. I thought that the Asian immigrant, when we first started working on this, I went, well, we don't need to include them and our representatives from the Hmong community in particular came back and said, no, Joel, you're wrong. And I said, they live a very healthy lifestyle. And they said, no, they lived a very healthy lifestyle. Now they came over here and they've adopted our lifestyle. And their diabetes is actually up there along with these other groups. And I had to go, okay, I stand corrected. That's why we have you as liaisons and partners within the community.
Okay. Senator Herr.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon and Mr. Gaither and Mr. Trinsky, you know, this is I'm very sure that this will give a good delivering outcome. You know, I have seen the effectiveness of TV and broadcasting, and I just want to add one more radio station to your list. Actually, the East Side radio station is a nonprofit, and they just got that going. So
yeah, low power FM.
I can talk to you more about that. After this session, where you can access a multiple ethnic radio program that will run your production.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I'd just like to address Senator Herr's comments.
Mr. Trzynski.
As well, thank you. Mr. Chairman, Senator Herr, we're used to these kinds of partnerships and collaborations, as you know, and we, I don't know about hiring staff, that's a little bit beyond me, but I know they do contract services and a variety of things to get the kind of expertise they need. These aren't top-down driven discussions. These are discussions coming from the community-based. If you saw the cancer programs we just recently did, the stories they told about cancer were the survivors of the cancer was their story. It wasn't the health experts telling you, here's what you got to do. It's a different kind of program. We're used to it. That's what we do in public television. That's how we educate people. So I think that's how I view them using that. Plus, again, the public media, the online distribution through free off the websites, it's downloadable. People look at that. And the other thing we do is we provide, we certainly provide CDs, discs that people can have for that's a senior center or a particular Asian community wants to have a particular event and they can have these CDs. We can make it available to everybody. We do all of that. I mean, we're very used to doing that in public television. And feel comfortable with that. And these, I'm surprised that the populations of specific programs throughout the state of Minnesota. It isn't just the populations here in the Twin Cities. It's throughout the state of Minnesota. And I think that's the other charm of it, up in the Red River Valley and what have you. We have those people identified. We can work with those communities. And we work with the general public. The general public will see these things on the air. And they'll be in English, a lot of them. So, I mean, that helps everybody.
All right. Senator Franzen, you had a
Thank
question?
You. I have a couple questions. Hopefully I can go through them real quickly here, Mr. Chair. Senator Sharon or Mr. Glazer. So it wasn't clear from the language of the bill, which is a very short bill, to ask for an appropriation of $1 million without – I'd rather have more meat in it. So I'm in the opposite side. And I do PR for a business, so if I'm going to ask for $1 million, I have to really spell out what I'm going to deliver. So when it talks about – for a prevention and education program. It doesn't really tell me you're developing it, how you're developing. It's not clear to me how that's going to be done, with what collaboration from those communities, because I do have concerns of being a top-down approach without getting the input from the communities. And you're alluding that you're going to do that, but I don't see it here, so I don't have assurances that that's the way the development of the program is going to be taking place. And I think that's crucial. I work with those communities, and the continued feedback I get is, you know, they don't hear input. So it needs to come, I think, bottoms up to create the content. That's my first concern and question, if you will, of how we can maybe elaborate more on this bill. The second is, you talk about your audience, but I need specifics of how much of these communities are you reaching. I like to see, is it 1%, 5%, where? So I don't have that in front of me. So I'm assuming the million, you know, reach that you might have, is it 50% that you're reaching communities of color? I doubt it, but I don't have the evidence. So I need to see that as well to know if that's the vehicle we want to use and what else do we need to leverage. Because, yes, maybe there's benefit to have it be over the wavelengths of the general audience, but that's not who we're targeting in this bill. We use the word must target. So if it's going beyond the scope, that we're not really targeting. So I need to know that. And then, you know, again, I need more details on the bill of how those funds are going to be used. Because maybe Senator Hurd thinks it's too low. I think it's too high because I don't know enough of what you're going to do with it. So that's just my reaction. I don't know if they want to respond to that, but those are my concerns about the bill as drafted.
Well, Senator
Sharon.
I think that the assumption here is that people understood that all of those things that you're talking about are built into these two systems. They're just inherent in the systems. But because that's not the case, what I hear you saying is that you'd like to see something added in terms of language that would clearly articulate at least that there'd be some measurement to let us know whether or not how broadly we were or how successful we were at meeting target populations. How do we know that we, in fact, as a result of this, met those target populations? So there should be some expectation that it's clearly indicated that that's the target here, but we can add language that says we'll come back and articulate, because they are able to articulate who their audience is and who is listening. You know who it is. And the other thing is language that clearly speaks about the bottom up, that how what is it that you're going to develop? How is it going to be developed? Who's going to be involved in the development? How will it involve the community? And language from an earlier comment, Senator, that it's clear that the product that is developed is available for distribution to to all organizations that are interested in distributing the information, no matter what format it is, 15-second, 30-second, 10-second, written, video, audio, whatever it is.
Okay. Senator Carlson had a question as well, and I think Senator Hur has a follow-up. Senator Carlson?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess the some of my questions have already been answered, but I guess I wanted to just verify that you're not planning to copyright, so this will be something that you can, that it will be available to community TV, to any place. And I guess I'm wondering, do you do PSA research and promotion? For instance, do you look for places for this play? For instance, the holiday pump, the gas pump, you know, something like that. I mean, you're professional, so I trust what you're saying and thinking. But I want to make sure that that there's some outreach there, that if you're going to be producing this, you don't just ask people to show up and come and get a copy, that you're going to actually promote it somewhat. Second one, you already mentioned some multiple lengths, perhaps, and I'm going to assume that this will also be closed captioned, too. Then also, what age groups? Now, you mentioned the program must be targeted to underserved and underrepresented communities. Are you going to look for young adults, children, or people my age? I am a diabetic, so I know that it happens at all ages and all stages, And I think most of us have gone through childhood, so that, you know, pretty much everybody gets the message if they get it as a child. So I'm hoping that there'll be something, I kept thinking, how do you attract the 90-second attention of a young person and, you know, just a few explosions and things? Maybe we'll get them to watch it. But for young people to get the message is extremely critical. And, I guess I could go on, but there's a lot of information that, or let's say small suggestions that are fairly easy to plant in young minds. And I think that might be something that you should hopefully have a little bit of focus on, is to get at the young people.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Glazer.
Just to touch on that briefly, I will tell you, and obviously then you're familiar with type 1, type 2. We are focusing almost exclusively on type 2. We in the past have done a tiny little bit on type 1. But the American Diabetes Association did allow us and actually encourage us to come to their diabetes camp. And we have done some outreach and work with children and plan to expand on that as well. And absolutely plan to tap every public service. We are very familiar. My background goes back to 19. I actually was a TV news producer prior to this career. Very familiar with who does and does not accept public service announcements and how to go about getting them. Unfortunately, most of them run between midnight and 5 a.m., but we'll take what we can get. But yes, we will be maximizing public service announcements and creating things that would be more likely to air, because they're not going to air a 90-second public service announcement. And other avenues, as you mentioned.
Senator Hurd.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to clarify the amount and the average production will be a lot. If you think the $1 million, it is a lot. But with the caliber of production that will be come out from TPT or NPR, perhaps this amount may be about right. But I am in concur with Senator Franson that we need to have extra, language here to make sure that, they are reaching out to the community that are targeted and, perhaps put in some language where a focus group is required. So we may need some support and some advice from the council to, I don't have the language, I can't come up with the language immediately for this, but, I would like to seek council help to come out with the language, and I will move from that.
If we were to, I think that's Senator Sharon.
I understand. Signaled yes.
A willingness to consider that. If this is picked up off the table, we'll make sure we have something along those lines. Senator Benson, did you also have a question or any other questions of members? Seeing none, anyone else in the audience who wished to offer testimony either in support or opposition to Senate File 1835? Seeing none, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying. Senator Sharon, move
yes.
Senate File 1835 as amended,
be
recommended
yes.
to pass and laid over for possible inclusion. On that motion, any further questions? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sharon. And that wraps up for tonight. We start at 8:30. Tomorrow we will be across the hall on Thursdays, so 8:30 tomorrow morning. Thank you, members. Stand adjourned.